You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Privatized prisons, Christy Clark's housing plan for the poor. That message was printed on a banner that was hung at the construction site of the new Surrey Remand Center last Tuesday. About 100 people staged a protest at that construction site. They then marched to Surrey RCMP office to stage a speak-out against what they refer to as the mass incarceration agenda. I'm joined in the studio by Iannis Ormond. Iannis is an organizer with VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which is based here in the downtown east side. VANDU led the organizing of that rally along with the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society. Iannis is also a host of People's Health Radio, which broadcasts here on Co-op every second Wednesday from 1 to 2. Welcome into the studio on a weekend,
Iannis. Thanks for having me.
So this new Surrey Remand Center isn't the only private prison project in BC underway right now. There's also going to be one in the Okanagan. What are the contract details of these private prisons?
The Surrey Remand Center is a 216 cell facility, so it's a large remand center. The price tag is about $136 million, and that one has been contracted out to a consortium led by Brookfield International, which is a huge Canadian property management corporation that manages $150 billion in assets worldwide or something, just gigantic. The Brookfield contract is to build, design, and maintain the facility. So we haven't turned the corner that they have in the US, where we have the actual management and prison guards employed by a private company. But what we're seeing is a creeping privatization that's happening within these Canadian prisons, and the introduction of profit as an element of our prison system, or a ramping up of profit. The second facility, there's no contract for yet. It was recently announced it's going to be in the Okanagan in Nirasoyus. It's a 350 cell remand, again, a remand center. So these are facilities that are designed to hold people for short periods of time with no rehabilitation, no programs, 23 hours in your cell. It's really warehousing. It's going to be built on the lands of the Soyuz Indian Band. It was actually rejected by Penticton. They had a plebiscite, and it was rejected by Penticton rejected hosting it. So it's being built on native land in Soyuz. It's a $200 million contract. So again, a huge expenditure by the provincial government. And we're expecting that one also to be a private-public partnership. So again, the introduction of this profit motive into our prison system.
How will that profit motive work compared to, say, the U.S. model?
Well, we're not yet at a point where you have kind of contracts for holding specific prisoners for specific periods of time, but these are long-term lucrative contracts. And there's also some recent ones in Ontario. So the new Toronto South Detention Center is a $1.1 billion contract to design, build, and maintain, again, this giant super jail in Toronto. So there's big corporations making money off of these contracts, and it creates a lobby for incarcerating more people and keeping more people in jail for longer is the concern. And we also think it's the thin edge of the wedge in terms of moving towards a more explicit privatized prison model. And certainly the minister in charge, Vic Taves, will not deny that they're looking very seriously at prison privatization at the federal level.
What implications would an expanded private sector role in the prison system mean for the incarceration of people?
Well, I think that, we're not concerned only about the privatization element. We're concerned about the general expansion of prisons in Canada and incarceration. And what we're seeing across Canada now is there are more than 60 individual prisons that are either being expanded or built across the country. They're building 9,000 spots, of which about 7,000 are, again, remand centers. This is short-term warehousing for people who are not being convicted of murder or serious crimes that you would do longer sentences for, right? So it's a massive expansion of the prison system, and the privatization element, again, creates a kind of corporate lobby for these policies and creates, I think, something that is abhorrent to most of us, the idea that somehow you're going to make money off of the human misery of locking up people who are overwhelmingly poor people. There's a quote, a recent quote from Hugh Siegel, who's a conservative senator, who said in an op-ed, people living under the poverty line in Canada make up less than 10% of the total population, but approaching 100% of the prison population, if you actually break it down and look at the demographics of who's in prison.
Yeah, well, actually, let's look further into those demographics. Like, what sectors of the population, well, within that 100% of low-income people, what are the different sectors of the population represented in prisons?
Yeah, well, one of the things that came up at the rally was if you're poor, and if you're Aboriginal, and if you're a drug user, that's three strikes, and these cells have a prison with a cell with your name on them. So that's really who's in prison right now. It's poor people. Native folks are massively over incarcerated, so they make up about 4% of the total Canadian population, but around 22% of the prison population. People of color, so particularly Blacks or African Canadians, make up again about 2.5% of the total population, but 10% of the prison population. We see a lot of people going to jail either for drug crimes or for drug-related crimes. So people who are addicted to illicit drugs, often in response to histories of collective and personal oppression and tragedy, are moving through these prisons like a revolving door. And again, there's actually cuts to any programs which you might be seen as rehabilitation or community integration. Those things are being cut by the federal government, but these remand centers are being built on a massive scale.
What are the actual charges that land people in prison? Like, your organization has a large membership of people who use illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. What kind of charges are they actually facing?
So the scary thing is that a very small proportion of charges laid in courts in Canada are for violent crimes. And there's a lot of people who are going to prison for what they call administration of justice charges. So something like 25% of the charges laid in Canada and somewhat less than that of people actually in prison at any given time are there for things like failure to appear at a court date, breach of a undertaking, breach of probation. So these are charges that are related mostly to being poor and not being able to navigate the legal system, honestly. Because if you have money, you're organized, you have a lawyer, you deal with these things. If you're extremely poor and marginalized, you have a lot harder time. And those are the people who end up with these charges and go to prison for them. So what we've seen in the downtown east side is you can get a ticket for vending, selling salvaged goods on the sidewalk, miss your court date, get a fine, get a failure to appear at your court date, and end up getting picked up by the cops and actually put in prison over a vending ticket. So that's the kind of thing that we're seeing, like that the prisons are being filled up with. It's largely not for crimes against people. It's largely for these kinds of procedural crimes and property crimes, which frankly, in many cases, are crimes of poverty and survival strategies for poor people.
Now, in organizing the protest, you partnered with the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, and you mentioned the overwhelming disproportion of Indigenous folks in prisons. What kind of analysis do you have coming out of organizations like that about why such large amounts of Aboriginal people are in prison?
Mm-hmm. Well, Lorna Bird, who's the outgoing president of the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, said straight up at that rally, this is just another residential school system. So there's really a sense of these prisons as being, I call it a successor system to the residential school system. So the people, the Native folks in prison are either residential school survivors or they're the sons or grandchildren of residential school survivors. There's kind of a seamless, if you look at the process of foster care, which was the replacement for residential schools as they were phased out. You see this massive ramping up of foster care. You know, kids, Native kids go into foster care, they go into group homes, and then they go into prison. And something like 45% of Native folks in Canadian prisons are under the age of 25. So it's a very young population. And it's, you know, there's no longer the kind of direct colonial strategy of assimilation that we saw in residential schools, but colonialism hasn't ended. It's just about locking people up now when they become socially problematic, right?
And now it's expanding.
Yeah, it's expanding, and there's reason to think that not only will the disproportionate incarceration of Native folks go down, but it will actually go up, because under the this federal omnibus crime bill legislation, they're actually placing severe limits on some of the strategies that were supposed to be used to de-incarcerate Native folks. So conditional sentences and kind of alternative practices in the community that were starting to be used as an alternative to incarceration for Native folks will no longer be an option for judges under some of these charges where there's mandatory minimums and restrictions on conditional sentencing.
Now, there's the omnibus crime bill of the Conservative federal government, but you know the BC government is involved with these prison expansions here. How is this mass incarceration agenda taking place across the country, across jurisdictions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really looking at it as not just because sometimes it gets played as kind of the Harper agenda, but there's actually this process of criminalization and creating more of a penal police state is taking place across jurisdictions. So there's prison building in every province and territory of the country right now. They're being built right across the country. At the federal level, I think the best way to look at it is in terms of budget. So at the federal level, you can see this multi-billion dollar investment in prisons at the same time as we're coming up on what looks like it's going to be an austerity budget. They're talking about cutting pensions. One of our chants at the action was pensions, not prisons. At the provincial level, we just had a budget from the BC Liberals that has de facto cuts to health and education. They're investing $336 million building these big prisons. And then at the municipal level, it's the police, and their budgets are untouchable. So in Toronto, the Rob Ford government made cuts to pretty much every city service that you can imagine, except the police, untouchable. In Vancouver, we see steadily escalating police budgets, and again, we're going to see a city budget shortly, which likely will have substantial cuts. But it's highly unlikely that we'll see any cuts to police, because what they do is they just hand down their budget. And you know, in terms of who the police are targeting and filling these prisons with, it's people coming out of poor communities. So there's really this kind of mining enterprise that happens in places like the downtown east side, where the beat cops are walking up and down the street looking for people that they can arrest with not too much work. And that's who's filling these prisons. We know it's not about escalating crime rates. It's not about protecting people. Certainly, to some degree, it's about protecting profit, but to a large degree, it's about protecting police budgets, which means justifying your budgets with these high rates of arrest and incarceration.
I really like your term there, mining enterprises.
Yeah. And I think the other kind of scary thing about this is there was a National Post article that the headline was the largest prison construction boom since the 1930s. And I really think this is also connected to economic crisis and what the response to the economic crisis is going to be. And we know it's not going to be expansion of the welfare state. I mean, that's pretty evident right now. Nobody's talking about increasing welfare rates or expanding EI or, you know, substantial job creation programs. So what we're having instead is expansion of the penal state, more police, more prisons, more spending on military. So I think we have to look at the big picture too, which is that the plan in the economic crisis is not to deal with poverty and unemployment through any kind of progressive Keynesian spending. It's going to be through locking people up and intimidating people.
So how would you suggest people support this fight back?
Well, I think, first of all, people just need to know that it's happening, like particularly with the prison building. It's shocking. And if people, if you Google that, a National Post article, you can read about this massive prison expansion across the country. It's really important. And just getting involved in raising awareness about it, I think, is the first step. And having the discussion about rates of incarceration really be on the agenda and up for discussion in our communities. Because right now, I think it's fairly hidden, and the people who are targeted are really marginalized. So they don't have a lot of capacity to illuminate what's going on in a lot of ways.
Well, thank you so much, Ines, for joining us in the studio and illuminating this complex, dynamic topic.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Ines Ormond. Ines is an organizer with VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users,